Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Thanks for joining us. I'm your host for this edition of Green Sense.
And I'm your executive producer, Bob Kessler. We're going to jump into the mixing bowl. No, we're not putting together flour and sugar and eggs. We're not making cookies here. Instead, it's the Mixing Bowl, an organization that blends together people from the food industry and the tech industry to make the food industry better. Also, there's a food item that could be going away because of climate change. Not exactly a dietary staple, but would you want to live in a world without this?
All coming up on this week's edition of Green Sense. I'm a big fan of real maple syrup. Nothing tastes better on waffles or pancakes. But if current emission trends continue, by the end of this century, it's predicted that global warming can kill the trees that make maple syrup. Dr. Inez Ibanez is with the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan and is on the line to tell us more. Welcome, Inez.
Thank you.
What inspired you to investigate the effect of climate change on trees used to make maple syrup?
Well, in our lab, we are studying trees in the temperate ecosystem. These are the hardwood forests that we have in eastern North America, and sugar maples are one of the dominant trees. So if we want to understand where these forests are going, we need to understand what sugar maple is doing.
What other types of trees are best tapped to make maple syrup?
Well, pretty much it's sugar maple is the species I know of, the only one that is being tapped for this kind of purpose.
Most maple syrup is produced in Canada, with the province of Quebec being the major producer, and the northeast and midwestern states, with Vermont being the bigger U.S. producer. That's a very large geographic area with many different climates and ecosystems. What has your research concluded? Will this entire area be impacted by climate change, or will certain areas or trees be more impacted than others?
So the areas that will be most impacted with respect to growth of these species are the ones that may become drier. So this is a species that relies on moisture during the whole growing season in the summer. So any area that may see reductions in soil moisture will be affected.
And are you predicting certain areas in this large geographic area that will be impacted most?
So it will mainly be in the southern region of where sugar maple grows. So if you think about where sugar maple is dominant, upper Midwest, upper New England, and New York, those are probably the areas in the United States that are going to be most affected. Canada, on the other hand, because it has already a colder climate, may not be affected that much.
So how doomed are syrup-producing trees? Is this something that's going to happen quickly, or do you see it happening over a long period of time?
It probably will be a gradual, and it will vary year to year. So if you think about the variability in weather conditions that we are experiencing year to year, so we'll have good years and then bad years, is that the number of bad years will become more frequent.
Could production be moved to other areas of the U.S. and Canada to protect the crop?
Yeah, so there will be areas, especially in Canada, that now will be open for these species to grow. Right now, they are too cold, but with global warming, you know, will be a desirable environment for these species. It's just the time it's going to take. Sugar maple is a tree that grows very slowly, so I'm not sure how many years or decades it takes for particular tree to start producing sap to the level that can be tapped. But it's probably to be quite a few years.
Have we seen any impact from climate change on current syrup production?
Yeah, so my understanding, this is not part of my particular research, but my understanding is that the number of days where trees can be tapped has been decreasing in the last few decades.
And what kind of economic impact or what kind of impact to syrup production has that caused?
Well, that's beyond my knowledge of this topic. I can give you a number. I don't know.
My guest is Dr. Inez Ibanez, and she's with the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. And we're talking about the impact on climate change on maple syrup production. So, Inez, tell me specifically, what are you doing with your research? What variables are you stressing, and how are you trying to show a correlation or an impact from climate change to syrup production?
Yeah, so we are studying temperate forests, the forests in eastern North America. We are studying not only how climate change is affecting them, but everything else that could affect them, like fragmentation of the landscape, introduction of pests. And we are focusing on the species that are dominant, like sugar maple, the ones that form the bulk of any particular forest, because if suddenly these species start performing poorly, it's not clear that could be replaced fast enough by other species that are better adapted to those new conditions. So that's the essence of what we are studying in our lab, is what is the forest dynamic that we should expect in the next few decades as a function of all these global change drivers.
It's so hard to isolate one variable when you're looking at the array of issues that can impact growth, you know, from climate and the environment. How do you isolate variables in a laboratory setting and then have data that's extrapolatable to a larger situation?
Yeah, so that's a very good point, because in a lab you can look at only one factor or maybe a combination of two or three, and the conditions are not realistic. So what we are doing is basing quite a bit of our work on natural settings. So we are collecting data for very large areas. So it's the bulk of the data and the variability of the conditions that data is represented that is allowing us to isolate the effects of these different drivers. Well, at the same time, we can also assess what is the combined effect of all these variables.
What is your hypothesis, and what do you expect your conclusions to show?
Well, we don't have a particular hypothesis saying this is going to be the winner or these are going to be the losers. We are a little bit more interested in thinking about forecasting. So we have these changing conditions. What are the species that are going to be performing better or not? So in the case of sugar maple, because it's in a species that relies so much on water availability, that's the reason why our hypothesis is that it's going to decrease in dominance, because the right conditions are going to become rare in the areas where it's growing right now.
Is there anything we can do to change or modify conditions to avoid this from happening and keep current crop production up?
Well, anything we can do to decelerate global warming will be a plus. So we are affecting the regional and global climate. So anything that makes that change to become slower, it would be helpful for sugar maple trees.
Well, one of the advantages of the Northeast Midwest is we're rich with fresh water. It can advanced irrigation techniques be one solution?
It could, but if you think about irrigating forests, it will be extremely costly. I mean, these trees consume large amounts of water, and also these trees are also helping to keep water into the system. So I don't know how reliable that solution will be.
Well, Well, syrup's not a dietary staple. Who wants to live in a world without it? How are you going to eat pancakes and waffles? So have people shown a strong response to hearing that it could go away one day?
Yeah, it seems to be the most interesting aspect of this research is what is going to happen with maple syrup. I mean, thank goodness we still have Canada, so we may have to rely on them to supply it.
Well, in closing, is there anything else you wanted to tell us about your research?
Forests are amazing ecosystems, so the more you can know about them and visit them, the better off you will be.
Well, thank you for joining us on Green Sense, and we wish you the best of luck with your research.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Ina Zabinis with the School of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense. We invite you to subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive, so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. Takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep Green Sense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you. Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Capital is the grease that lubricates the wheels of innovation. But you need more than capital to make an idea into a company. You need an ecosystem of expertise. The Mixing Bowl works to help make connections in the ag tech sector so ideas can grow. And we're joined by founder Rob Trice. Rob, welcome to Green Sense.
Thanks for having me.
Ag tech is a new investment category that came about, I don't know, somewhere between 5 to 10 years ago. It's diverse and it includes big corn and big cattle to software to alternative sustainable farming. Rob, tell us more about how you define the ag tech sector.
So I think fundamentally when you look at tech, it's the use of technology to create food, fuel, and fiber at its most basic element. And there are a lot of different categories, subcategories that go into ag tech. And I think there is also a lot of confusion in the marketplace about what really is ag tech. It can be seed technology, soil technology, supply chain, store. We even look in our space, we also look even out to the stomach. So seed, soil, supply chain, store to stomach is for food. That's what we look at in regard to ag tech. But there's other people that can look at the production of biofuels and consider that ag tech as well.
Rob, beside capital, what are other expertise that makes up the investment ecosystem?
Well, I mean, I think the fundamental thing in ag tech is obviously an understanding of the crops and the soil. The supply chain is still a really big issue. How do you get that product out of the field and through the supply chain and to the marketplace. And, you know, one of the themes that we hear about when we're talking about how we're going to feed 9 billion people by 2050 is food waste. And where does that food waste actually occur? Is it in the field? Is it in the supply chain? Or is it in your refrigerator? And there's all of this different. I think part of the issue is ag and food is 10% of the world's economy. It is so large. It's really hard to comprehend all the different moving pieces that make up our quote-unquote food system.
Much of the capital funding ag tech is coming from the coasts. You're an example. You're out in the Bay Area. And with many of these ideas and innovations coming from the Midwest, is there a culture clash out there between the two very different East and West Coast investor mentalities and Midwestern innovators?
So, look, I say this as somebody who has lived in Ohio, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Missouri, and I don't think that in most cases that there is really a culture clash. Perhaps you could look at kind of a Midwest conservatism versus a more progressive or mindset out on the coast. But I think the other thing that's for me very interesting is, and a little bit worrisome, is that disconnect in terms of the investors and really understanding where their food comes from and how it really is produced. And I think that the fundamental difference is, do you want to take our existing food system and make incremental improvements, or do you really want to go disrupt it and produce food in a different way? And this is where I think the space of food production is very much different than something like social media, in the sense that tweeting and eating are very different. Making a change to an app is much different than making a change to a food product. An app, if that app doesn't work, that's a bad thing. If a food product is bad, you can actually kill someone.
Let's talk about that for a second. So Silicon Valley has found agriculture, and a lot of high-tech money is looking to fund ag technology ventures. And as we were talking, I call it a culture clash. You call it a disconnect. But product rollout is a lot slower when you're dealing with an asset-based biological production, such as farming, whether you're raising cattle or raising fruits or vegetables. And it's much different than software development. Tell us a little bit about how the Silicon investment model works with ag tech and where that clashes.
Well, and so we're making investments in IT for food and agriculture under the name of Better Food Ventures. And our whole objective is to use IT to inject more precision, agility, sustainability, and profitability into food production. And I sincerely do believe that we can do a better job. And there are areas right now where we have a data loop that will allow a farmer to see how his nitrogen application last week, how did that take root on the back 40? Or what happened with that hailstorm? What kind of damage occurred? But I would say that fundamentally, there's a big difference in three elements. One is speed, safety, and scale compared to other areas or verticals that we look at. Speed, you may only have one crop per year, so you don't get a fast feedback loop like you do with a social media application. Safety, I mentioned this out, the issue that you have to move slowly to make sure that whatever you're providing consumers is safe and stable. And the last one is scale. And that's the hardest thing, I think, because we do have a lot of interdependencies in our supply chain to get food into consumers' mouths. And that's where I think there's going to be a lot of room for investment going forward.
My guest is Rob Trice with The Mixing Bowl, and we're talking about the emerging ag tech sector and how to fund good ideas here on Green Sense. I'm Robert Colangelo. Rob, what are some of the biggest challenges you see facing the food industry in the U.S., and how can technology help solve them?
Well, so we talk often about feeding 9 billion people by 2050. What I like to say, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, is I'm not worried about 2050, but rather how can we inject more agility and precision and sustainability and profitability into our food system now so that 1,000 flowers can grow? And as we're tackling big issues like food waste or indoor ag production, that by the time we get to 2050, there's going to be a plethora of ways to feed the world sustainably, adequately, and to have good health and nutritional outcomes. But I think that the challenge, one of the challenges, you talked about that culture clash. One of the challenges is this misinformation about where food actually comes from and then how we're going to change it. And I think that is, there's not just one right way that food is going to be produced. Rather, we should embrace a number of different ways to create a lot of different arrows in our quiver going forward.
Rob, let's talk a little bit about getting inside your head as an investor so that you can share some maybe tips with the audience. What do you look for in a startup company when you're looking to make an investment?
I mean, fundamentally, it comes down to a team, a technology, and a market. And if you look at those three basic elements, it's the team that you really need to bet on. So the technology, you can always upgrade. And the market, you can also always pivot to a new market, but it's the team, and that's really what makes, in my mind, a really good investment is getting behind a good team and somebody that you can actually work with. And you know, one of the things that we like to say is when you make these investments, the average time from an investment to a liquidity event might be 7 years, and you may actually be spending more time with your CEO than with a loved one. And you're going to have some very harsh conversations. And so as you're making these investments, you actually want to treat this like it's a relationship that you're getting into, much more than just casual dating. And you really want to understand what makes that person tick. What are their incentives? And to make sure that you've got that alignment of incentives and that you're driving towards the same outcomes.
Rob, I like your simple speak. That was pretty clear. So share with us some stories from the field on realistic and unrealistic expectations, both from capital providers and those from companies seeking capital.
I've got a great story for you. You know,
radio's great for stories, so go ahead, let it roll.
So my partner, Shauna, publishes something called the AgTech Landscape Map, and she tracks over about 1,700 AgTech deals in about 35 or 40 different subcategories. And one that she's looked at that we look at as overfunded is drones for agriculture. And, you know, the reality is that we have about, I don't know, 60 or 80 companies going after that space. I think for a lot of the farmers, the drones don't yet have a practical application other than maybe visual inspection of one field and another, but particularly in the Midwest where you have super large farms, those drones don't yet have the capability to do flyovers of an entire farm and do something productive on it. Well, we ran across a blueberry farmer and he said, yeah, I've got a need for a drone. And we perked up our ears and he said, I need a drone that mimics the flight of a falcon to scare birds off my berries. And I don't think that's necessarily one of the kind of things that a venture capitalist is going to be looking to back. But this is one more theme, if I can, just to extend a little bit more. I think there are a lot of applications of technology for agriculture. The issue is in a lot of them, it's not necessarily something that might be venture backable or be able to get a venture type return. As an example, I mean, I just look at things like there's a collaborative application called Slack. And it's free to download on mobile phones. And we have a dairy farmer out here in California, and he uses that to coordinate tasks amongst his team members. And that happens to be venture capital backed. But there are a lot of these things like Google Docs, Square for payments at the farmers market that are lower level technologies. And it's an extension of existing technology to a new market in agriculture or food.
Rob, any stories you could share on the other end? Where are unrealistic expectations from investors?
Well, I think we've got some very interesting ones to watch. On the ag side, we just had $200 million go into a company that's fundamentally pre-revenue that is doing indoor growing. And so they are producing, are planning to produce lettuce all over the world. And that company is going to have to produce millions of pounds of lettuce per day to get a venture backable, venture type exit for its investors. The other one that I think is going to be very interesting is a company called Impossible Foods that is basically growing meat in a lab to eliminate our need for, animal-based meat. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been invested in this fundamentally to produce a hamburger. You have to sell a lot of hamburgers to recoup hundreds of millions of dollars of investment. So I just use those as two examples of companies that we're going to watch. They're big bets. They're change the world bets. And we'll just see if they actually come to fruition or not.
Rob, I have a whole list of questions I wanted to ask you. Things like autonomous tractors to farmer fatigue from taking up all these high technologies. So I'm just going to have you back on the show. So I really appreciate your input and enjoyed your insight in how an investor thinks and looks at the emerging ag tech market.
Thanks for having me.
Mixing Bowl founder Rob Trice speaking with us on GreenSense. We'd love for you to subscribe to our program when you visit greensensefarms.com. Our podcast is available on all your favorite platforms. We hope you enjoyed this week's show. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. We have a wonderful show coming up next week. All you have to do is tune in. In the meantime, stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.